I hope you like what I have to say today, because it may make you happy, it may make you depressed. I'm here to try to inspire, but what I have to talk about may upset you, so be prepared. I'm not here to talk about free speech. I'm not here to talk about the right to protest and assemble. Rather, what I want to talk about is the limit to protest. You know, limits of protest, and in some ways, the need for politics of liberation. What we just heard in terms of this liberation charter is brilliant, and I think important, and I'm glad it came before what I had to say, because in some ways it lays a foundation that we need to think about where we're going and what we're imagining. And all three speakers made this point, you know, ahead of me, and I just want to reiterate it. Now, if we get 500,000 people in the streets of New York to disrupt the RNC, this is great. This is fantastic. Okay, there's no question about it. Protests will disrupt business as usual. It'll send a message to the world that there are people in this country that don't accept the current fascist policies that we're up against and don't accept Bush, and that there's a struggle to remove him. It will send a message that there are people in this country who reject empire. It may even bring stock prices down, you know? You never know. It may even contribute to Kerry's election. We don't know, you know, but it's going to do something. It's very, very important. And I don't want to at all question the importance of being out here the next couple of weeks and being out here for the rest of our lives if that's what it takes. But protests alone don't produce the kind of society that many of us dream about. It won't create the conditions of our liberation, in part because liberation requires a transformation of the culture, you know, transformation of the way we think, what we do. It requires deep connections to communities and developing new ways of thinking. Liberation cannot be seized or toppled, nor is it driven by anger, frustration, or oppression. Okay? It's a struggle to change ourselves and in the process to build what we might call the beloved community. I know that sounds corny, but the beloved community in some ways is what we're trying to achieve. You see, I mean, I'm a socialist. That's what socialism was about, I thought. You see, and I'm still a socialist, and I think that we can do better than, you know, capitalism is, we know how destructive it is, but we have to really try to think about where do we go from here, and what does the beloved community look like? In fact, what's interesting about the film we saw at the beginning, it kind of set the stage for our discussion and for the protest, and the thing I wish I had seen in the film was the part where the Zapatistas talk about how to create community, you know, how to rearrange the land and how to speak to one another. Because in some ways, that's the most dangerous revolutionary thing we could do, you know? I mean, battling the police is dangerous, but remaking ourselves. Okay, so for many of us on the left, protest has become a way to connect. It becomes a culture, a way of life. You know, in some ways, it's very, very important, but we have to think about other ways to build solidarity. Protests are generally acts of self-defense. They are ephemeral coalitions or united fronts where people come together to stop some destructive acts or policies. Social movements, on the other hand, are affirmative, collective struggles to build a new society, hopefully. And we can look at struggles of freed people to build democracy in the South during Reconstruction. We could look at the Civil Rights Movement, the Poor People's Campaign. We could look at the feminist movement, perhaps social unionism. There's all kinds of examples. And all these movements have tried with varying success to change the culture. They've created institutions anchored in communities and challenged power at the level of ideology. Most of these movements generated visions of a different society, visions that were produced by collectives and shaped by struggle. And it should be remembered that some of the most radical social movements worked under conditions of duress that are worse than what we face today. Now, I know things are bad. There's no question about it. But the 1880s were bad, especially for black people, you know? It was a jacked up time, you know? You could walk down the street and get lynched. So I'm with Vijay. I mean, social movements have made a difference, a huge difference. We can't forget that. Things are terrible now. But despite that, despite those conditions, movements have emerged, erupted, succeeded in some ways of maintaining humanity of people inside those movements. A big part of the problem that we face today is that, you know, the left in some ways is disconnected, not the entire left, but much of the left, you know, is kind of disconnected from, you know, working class communities, the poor, and there's a kind of segregation that still exists. You know, there's people of color movements that are doing all this work, and then there are people who sort of talk who are kind of disconnected from people of color movements. who might be working with labor and that sort of thing. So there's connections, but there's a lot of disconnection. And that disconnection is evident, I think, in the way that the so-called left responded to the 2000 election. I mean, when Bush was elected without the majority of the votes, one of the first things that happened, I remember, in terms of the discussions that were taking place, particularly among a lot of white leftists, was that, you know, Nader's a spoiler. Ralph Nader was the person. There was very little discussion at first about the disenfranchisement of black voters, which was the real key thing. Now, of course, now we talk about it thanks to work by people like Greg Palast and others. I mean, now it's really hot on the agenda, and very few people are talking about that. They talk about Florida, and it's so evident now with the intimidation of elderly voters. I mean, if you saw Bob Herbert's column today in the New York Times, that stuff is going on. Now, of course, had we been paying attention, we'd know that this is not new. And I'm not talking about going back to the 1880s. We go back to the 1990s under Clinton, when Attorney General Janet Reno was in office. In the mid-90s, there was all kinds of intimidation against voters and black voters in Alabama. The FBI was investigating voter fraud and actually trying to prosecute, the Justice Department trying to prosecute black voters and black elected officials when there were all these cases of white voter fraud, like the election of Selma's mayor, Joe Smitherman, for example, which went untouched. And it's interesting, this happened in the mid-90s at the same moment when churches were being burned. So the FBI was showing up to people's houses saying, and they're thinking they're coming to see about the burned churches, but instead they're investigating, you know, black voter fraud, you know, and it was all bogus in the end. So, I mean, this is the sort of situation we're in. We got to pay attention to race. Race and racism is still here with us. Of course, we've been here before. After Reconstruction, which ended in a similarly fraudulent election of a president who did not win the majority of the votes, black people suddenly found themselves disenfranchised, subject to a wave of terrorism, both legal and extra-legal. They had their land seized. They reduced the debt peonage. And what did they do? What did those people do? They built and sustained powerful democratic institutions in their own communities throughout the South and the urban North. They tried to create a community culture based on mutuality, based on respect and sharing. And in this case, they were driven by a prophetic vision of Christianity, but at heart was an ethos that said, we're in this together, we will help each other survive. And they continued to fight back too, and that's another story. But the most important thing I want to emphasize here is that they tried to create the future in the present. They tried to create the future in the present. And this is a point that, you know, C.L.R. James coined that term, and this is what I want to talk about. What I want to advocate tonight is that in addition to, not in place of, but in addition to the kind of protests that we're all going to be engaged in, we should follow the lead of several incredible grassroots organizations and begin to build the future in the present. We need to connect with local communities and help build institutions that allow us to remake ourselves, that create spaces that allow us to dream of a different future and enact those dreams. And there's so many organizations, some are here, that are doing this kind of work. I mean, you mentioned CAB and DRUM and Domestic Workers United. There's the Bog Center in Detroit, which I was going to talk about, but time is short, I won't. What I want to do is limit myself to one organization, which is, to me, one of the most amazing, important organizations that we need to pay attention to. They're represented here. That's Sister to Sister. They're based in Bushwick neighborhood in Brooklyn. Yeah. Definitely. And in their own words, they are, quote, a collective of working class young and adult black and Latina women building together to model a society based on liberation and love. Our organization is dedicated to working with young women to develop personal, spiritual, and collective power. We are committed to fighting for justice and creating alternatives to the systems we live in by making social, cultural, and political change. Now, like the Bog Center in Detroit, they have a long-standing freedom school for young women of color. They've already had almost 500 graduates who have gone on to work in other progressive organizations, become school teachers, and continue to work in the collective. And I recently spoke with one of the amazing organizers, Paula Rojas, who's my hero, who told me about some of the work that they're doing, which I'd like to share with you, and examples of the politics of liberation that I'm trying to advocate here, and that is creating the future in the present. One of the issues that the women face, all over the globe, but in this case in Bushwick, is violence, both domestic and interpersonal violence and state violence in the form of police harassment. So Sister to Sister had been waging a campaign against police violence, like many organizations, but then the collective recognized the fundamental contradiction. That's this. Victims of domestic violence generally rely on police to intervene. Police officers are among the highest perpetrators of domestic violence themselves, not to mention the threat to the community, so why turn to them? That was the question. That was a fundamental contradiction. So what do? They ask themselves, in our vision of how we want the world to be, how would we deal with interpersonal violence without the police? So they looked at other models around the world, especially in Latin America, and came up with the concept of sisters liberated ground, creating spaces where violence against women is not tolerated. These spaces included designated buildings, schools, parks, and to protect these spaces, a circle of women who were trained in self-defense and conflict resolution. They would deal with violence not as individuals, not as households, but as a community issue. And they would confront abusers together. The purpose, of course, is to change the culture, to create a society where no one in the neighborhood tolerates violence against women, and the entire community looks after each other to protect and educate each other. They do street theater that enacts some form of abusive behavior and then shows how interventions can take place. They hold video screenings and discussions in the community about domestic violence. And what they have been doing is slowly, working. I mean, it's really changing the culture. There were men initially hostile to Sister to Sister who had begun to come around, and more people are approaching the collective about making their own buildings Sisters Liberated Ground. Now, to me, this is amazing revolutionary work. Amazing. It's very, very important. It's dangerous work. It's dangerous work. And yet, once they extended their focus beyond traditional protests against police brutality to creating a safe space and community culture that no longer tolerates domestic violence, their funding started to disappear. Now, isn't that deep? And funding from where? From progressive left funders. You see? Why? Because they can't conceive of this as actual work, as actual real organizing work. And yet, this is precisely what liberation is about, radically transforming ourselves and our culture. And it is driven by an ethic of love for community. And as Paul Rojas told me recently, the work feels different when you're doing it out of sister solidarity, not just a hatred of the police. Now, the central point that I'm trying to make is that, we organize to build something. We struggle because of love and communities we care about, not just opposition to our oppressors. That's not a way to build a movement because it does sustain itself. That's why when Steve Williams and we had Red and the other sister whose name read the Liberation Charter, in some ways this is about trying to create humanity, a humane life. It's not just about resistance against oppression. It's about what you build. And to me, in some ways, this is what we should be doing. There's so many other organizations that are doing this, creating collectives for economic self-sufficiency and childcare, providing political education for working mothers, building models based on what's developing Cuba and Nicaragua and Brazil. And the activists and sister, of course, turned to Latin America and other third world liberation movements for inspiration and ideas. And the fact that they do this kind of brings me to my final point, which is that true liberation requires a commitment to anti-imperialism, and solidarity with the oppressed worldwide. And, Naomi's talk, this is exactly her point. It's not enough to be in a peace movement and say end to war. You've got to actually be in solidarity with the people who they're waging war with. It happened in Vietnam. You can't just say you're sort of against the war in Vietnam. You've got to be for the people in Vietnam. You've got to be for the people in Iraq. And what that requires is that we, as a people, need to liberate ourselves from American nationalism and embrace humanity. There's no such thing as a left patriotic position. And it just kills me that these like so-called leftists who wrap themselves around the flag, that just doesn't make any sense to me. Now, put simply, the victims of imperialism are our allies, pure and simple. We cannot afford to embrace blind patriotism that defines loyalty in terms of support for the ruling interests of the nation state. Wherever the U.S. empire raises its ugly head, abroad or right here in the ghettos of North America, working people and their allies across national borders need to be prepared to do battle. We need to follow the example of the French and Caribbean surrealists, who in 1932 published a broadside called Murderous Humanitarianism, in which they vowed to change the, quote, imperialist war in its chronic and colonial form into a civil war. As activists and working people living here in the U.S., we have to bear much of the responsibility for waging a sustained attack on imperialism. We need to continue to organize teach-ins, provide material, moral, and tactical support for victims of U.S. wars of aggression, battle both Republican and Democrats over foreign and domestic policies, support international justice efforts such as the Third World Tribunal in Iraq. And I don't think it's an exaggeration to suggest that the American empire threatens the future of humanity. And I'm obviously not the first one or the last one to say it. In fact, nearly half a century ago, W.E.B. Du Bois warned us of the consequences of the new American empire. His words are startlingly prescient. He says, quote, "Today, we are lying, stealing, and killing. We call all this by finer names, advertising, free enterprise, and national defense. But names, in the end, deceive no one. Today, we use science to help us deceive our fellows. We take wealth that we never earned, and we are devoting all of our energies to kill, maim, and drive insane men, women, and children who dare refuse to do what we want done. No nation threatens us. We threaten the world." Now, I know, I wish I said that. Du Bois said that, you know. He's the man. Just to conclude, in the end, we're about to embark on something that's bigger than Bush, bigger than Kerry, bigger than Democrats and Republicans, bigger than Homeland Security, and bigger than the CIA. We must fight these battles as they come. We must also begin to build the future in the present. And for this, this is the key to revolution, okay, to revolution. And I said the word revolution because I think that we need revolution. Revolution is a word we can't be afraid of. We need revolution. The survival of much of the world depends on it. But what is revolution? Revolution is not burning down buildings or the violent seizure of the state or filling Central Park with anti-Bush supporters. That may be road towards it, but that's not revolution. It means developing a vision of a new world and working to build it, and wherever it's possible to live it, to create our communities as liberated zones and try to figure out how to become what we want to be. It means putting some of the old books aside and drawing on the wells of our collective imagination, an imagination fired by active participation in the very social movements that we'll be a part of in the next week, the very protests we'll be involved in the next couple weeks. It means, you know, engaging with real people, not on the internet and not just in demonstrations. It means self-transformation and community participation, but it also means seeing the whole world and taking seriously a commitment to internationalism. You see, it means learning to respect the knowledge and experience and strength of so-called ordinary people. It means working together to purge ourselves and our communities of the racism and sexism and homophobia that still persists, even among the left. And perhaps most importantly, we don't have to wait until November 2nd to do this. You see, we can begin right now. And for those of us committed to liberation, we really need to, you know, wake up and start to dream. Thank you very much.